This is the Utah Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Schott, political correspondent for the Salt Lake Tribune. Longtime political consultant and strategist Stuart Stevens says he had the best win-loss percentage in the Republican Party. He's worked as a strategist and media consultant for GOP candidates up and down the ballot, including President George W. Bush. He was also the chief strategist for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. Despite that deep well of experience, Stevens is still struggling to understand how the party of Lincoln so rapidly turned into the party of Trump. Stevens is the author of the new book, It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. He'll join me on the podcast in a moment to discuss how we got to this political moment and why he says the days leading up to November's election are the most dangerous time for America since the Civil War. Before we get to that discussion, I would like to ask you for a favor, though. If you like what you hear on this podcast, please consider leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or iTunes. That helps new people find the show. I'd also appreciate it if you'd take a few moments to share this episode on social media. For you new listeners who have just stumbled across the podcast, welcome aboard. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Now that that bit of housekeeping is out of the way, let's get to my conversation with Stuart Stevens. Joining me today on the podcast is Stuart Stevens. He is a former GOP strategist. He was Mitt Romney's top strategist in 2012. He played some key roles on both of George W. Bush's campaigns. He says he has the best one-loss record in the Republican campaign world, but not a Republican anymore. His new book is called It Was All a Lie. Stuart, thanks for joining me.
Brian, it's great to be here, buddy. Thank you.
So let's talk about your book. It was obviously a reaction to Trump being elected. And in that time, we see that the Republican Party has, you know, from an outside observer, has pretty much abandoned all of the conservative values that they claim to hold, which are things like limited government, no deficits. Now it's just the party of Trump. What happened?
Well, listen, that asking that question is what led me to write this book. You know, a lot of people were wrong in 2016 about Trump, but it's really hard to find anybody who was more wrong than me. I didn't think he'd win the primary or the general. And then after he won, I went through this period that I think a lot of people, Republicans kind of in my world did, you know, trying to convince myself he really wasn't the Republican Party, like something had happened here. I can't really sustain that. I mean, because he is the Republican Party. You know, Republican Party is the party that endorsed Roy Moore and attacked John Bolton. And asking that question of what happened is what led me to write this book. And it led me to really look at the history of the party in the post-World War II era. And that's what the book is.
One of the things that I've heard you say in numerous interviews, and it has really stuck with me, is that, you know, some elements of the Republican Party, the racist part, the anti-immigrant part, the nativist part of the party, you said you always knew that it was part of the DNA of the party, but you always thought it was a recessive gene. But now you say it's always been a dominant gene. I don't think that's always been the case. You know, I look back, I'm reading Rick Perlstein's book right now, Reaganland, which is about the rise to power Reagan. And one of the things that shocked me, I was really young when he came into power, but he was very pro-immigrant. In fact, he was advocating for open borders between the United States and Mexico when he was facing off against George H.W. Bush for the Republican nomination in 1980. They were falling all over themselves to see who could be the most pro-immigrant. So, you know, I don't think that's always been the case. But I understand those elements have always been.
The way I look at it is I think you can trace the history of this tension in the party back to the 50s with Eisenhower and Joe McCarthy, kind of a governing sane wing and sort of a lunatic wing, call it lunatic, paranoid, nativist is a good word. Birchers. I always worked on the other side of the party. And I assumed, as did I think a lot of us, that we were, to borrow the phrase, on the right side of history, that we might lose this race or that race, but that ultimately the direction of the party would be in the direction we wanted to push it, if only because it was so obvious that that's where the country was going. And ultimately, organizations tend to do what is in their best interest. So the idea that in a very changing America, you had to change just seemed like obvious. You know, if you go back to the George Bush campaign in 2000, you know, I went down to Austin in April 99, and a lot of what I think the governor went through was sort of asking himself, in this year, 1999, conservatism was sort of a victim of its own success. What had been the tenets? You know, anti-communism, well, we won the Cold War. Welfare reform, well, Bill Clinton did welfare reform. Taxes, well, they were down. You know, they weren't 70%. Crime was down. So he evolved that concept of compassionate conservatism. And, you know, if you remember at the time, he got a lot of grief from some on the right that said, well, so look, Governor, are you saying that conservatism isn't compassionate? And Bush's answer was, yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, I am. The way that, you know, or we haven't presented that image of it. And to him, the key was education. You know, it's what the issue that he really cared about. And the first piece of legislation was No Child Left Behind. You know, and he look at that picture. He signed it with Ted Kennedy over his right shoulder. Today, that'd be like committed to the Hague for a war crimes tribunal. You know, like, here, ladies and gentlemen, you know. We have proof. And I think you can make a case. It kind of breaks my heart. But, you know, that vision of the party, our last chance to execute that was probably died in 9/11 when he became the wartime president.
Yeah. And let's get to that in a second. But you mentioned you always worked on the other side of the party. But to play the devil's advocate here, didn't the Republican Party embrace that other part of the party in order to have a coalition? They embraced. I think back to Thomas Frank's book, What's the Matter with Kansas, where he talks about how the country club Republicans embrace the virulent anti-abortion wing of the party because that's how they could accomplish their policy goals of tax cuts. And I wonder if part of the problem is sort of feeding that dog. And then now it's come back to bite the Republican Party because they let it get too much power.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, in my world, I would be working for candidates like in primaries, and there'd be like my guy or my woman versus the other. And we were I think I can say that, you know, I was on the side of the party that was against that. So Bill Weld in 1990 in Massachusetts, first Republican governor elected in 20 years. Well, Weld couldn't even get on the ballot at the state convention, which I think you only needed 30%. So we went a petition route. And then we won that Republican primary in 1990 from the left. We attacked the guy who had become the Republican Party choice at the convention. We attacked him for being against abortion and won. And, you know, I worked for Tom Ridge, who was pro-choice in a limited Pennsylvania way, which you could argue is pro-life with exceptions. I mean, you sort of get it narrowed. But so I always saw that. So, you know, you go down even to 2014 after Romney lost, I was involved in this brutal campaign in Mississippi for incumbent Senator Thad Cochran running against in a primary against a guy named Chris McDaniel, who in retrospect was very much a precursor of Trump. We were attacked for actively seeking African-American support in the primary, because in Mississippi, you don't have primary registration. So, you know, I always saw myself as, you know, I didn't work for the Jesse Helms. I didn't work for those guys. But as a whole, did the party do too much? Yeah, probably. I mean, it's complicated, which is really why I wrote a book and not an article. What I would have thought, though, Brian, and what really shocked me was, you know, I would have said, if you look back in the dark ages, say 4 years ago, there would have been this differences of opinion, but unanimity on some 90% plus key principles like character counts, personal responsibility, strongly pro-legal immigration, like you were saying, pro-free trade, for the idea that culture is important. And now it's not that the party is drifted away from those things, which parties do, you know. We're against all those things. I mean, in the Reagan era, we said what a president says is so important, it can bring down the Berlin Wall. And now we go, look, it's just Trump. It's just words. What does it matter? And Bill Clinton, you know, you had people like William Bennett writing this beautiful stuff about the president is sort of the embodiment of the country and what he does matters, and it's more beyond. And now with Trump, you know, I believed all that. I worked for Bob Dole. You know, I work for George Bush. Now with Trump, it's like, well, look, we're not electing him preacher. It doesn't matter. And, you know, for Russia, I mean, we're to the left of Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie went to, you know, honeymoon in Russia, but he didn't like marry Putin. Mm-hmm. And I've just never said, I say, I've never seen anything like it, but I don't think we've seen anything like it.
I can tell that you're still struggling with what happened, because this is a party that you devoted pretty much your entire professional life to, and you're still struggling trying to come to grips with what happened here. You know, I'm fascinated, and perhaps that's the wrong word, but the fact that there was no platform adopted at this year's Republican convention. Now it's just whatever Trump says goes. That is absolutely mind-boggling.
I finished this book about a year ago, and it's a pretty bleak portrait of the Republican Party, right? But I realize now I was overly optimistic. I mean, I never would have thought in a million years that they wouldn't even pretend to have a platform. I mean, this is basically a Führer oath, and it's extraordinary. I mean, it is like you've joined Tony Soprano's gang, and Trump is a gangster, and that's how he operates. And with this odious family, you know, I mean, Meadow Soprano, I think at least she went to law school instead of Ivanka.
And she was working with low income.
Yeah, she had some redeeming social value. I really don't, you know, the only thing I can compare it to is the collapse of communism, where what people, that the party said it was and what it was for, is just so disparate that it just collapsed. And that's what's going to happen to the Republican Party. That is what's happening to the Republican Party.
Are you still in mourning over this? You and I can see each other, and this is going to the only thing that's going to be posted is the audio. But I can see almost anguish in your face as you're talking about.
Look, it's incredibly painful. You know, I was drawn to the Republican Party for a lot of reasons, but one of the strong ones was the sense of personal responsibility. So I don't know where to begin if I actually believe that, except to take personal responsibility. You know, there's a genre of books that people write about politics that's like, if only they had listened to me. You know, John Bolton just wrote one. Mm-hmm. That's not my book because they did listen to me. You know, as I say in the book, I'm not bitter about it. Like, I won. You know, I was at the top of all this. I was, you know, well rewarded for it. I'm not bitter. I mean, if I went on television and started praising Donald Trump and saying, you know, I was wrong, I get it now, in 3 weeks, I could be like highest paid person in the Trump campaign, I guarantee you, because he's completely transactional. And yeah. I've likened it to watching a friend drink themselves to death. And, you know, part of what really pains me is that, you know, all these people I worked for and with, they're good people. I mean, if you lived next door to them, they'd be great neighbors. If they saw you on the street, you know, broken down, they'd help you with your car. I mean, these aren't evil people. And yet the party has allowed and been complicit in an evil person being president of the United States. And there's no other way to look at that.
Do you think that there is cynicism at the base of this shift to falling behind Trump? Do you think that it's the way that they get power? It's the way that they get political power. I mean, I look at people like Mitch McConnell. I look at people, you know, maybe Mike Pence. They saw Trump as a path to accomplishing things they want to do politically. And that's a very cynical look at it. But, you know, there's also others in this coalition behind Trump who fervently believe what he says and who he is. And they're 100%, their hearts and minds are with him. I'm wondering if your former colleagues, if you sense more of a cynicism about their support for Trump, or if they're actually behind.
I know a lot of these people. I have never had a conversation with a Republican elected official who thought Donald Trump was qualified to be president. Not one. Now, you know, I don't talk to the, you know, Jim Jordans of the world, but I bet if he got a drink or two in Jim Jordan, he'd say that. It there's an element of cynicism, but I think, and I write this, I think the overwhelming characteristic is just straight up cowardice. I don't think it's complicated.
Good point.
I think they're just afraid. And that's what really disgusts me. So, I mean, these are heirs to the greatest generation, right? I mean, people like my dad, who was just like hundreds of thousands of others, 3 years in the South Pacific fighting, 28 island landings. My uncle, his brother, you know, machine gunned in Europe, never really recovered. Then they came back, they never talked about it. You know, that's the legacy that was handed to these politicians. And they're afraid of Donald Trump. I mean, courage isn't standing up to Donald Trump. Courage is getting out of the boat when the guy in front of you just got shot. And that's what they've squandered. And I think that they will be looked upon with disgust and shame in history. They're just weak people.
I think I heard you say once that Mitch McConnell believes that Donald Trump will be seen as his fool, and you actually believe it's going to be the reverse.
Look at George Wallace. I go back to this. You know, George Wallace, I'm from Mississippi. You know, George Wallace did some good things as governor. He passed free textbooks. There's not anybody out there that's remembered as the free textbook George Wallace guy. They're just the George Wallace guy. And to be the same with Trump. Yeah. None of this stuff's going to matter. You know, this all this nonsense about conservative judges. Really? You really think that they're going to remember, you know, so-called conservative judges when you have a president who attacks the judicial system? Like, I had to support, you know, Donald Trump so that I could, for conservative judges, so I support a president who's the chief law enforcement officer of the country who attacks the American judicial system. I mean, if you said that, like, in a college interview, they go, like, what? You know, like, really confused. You haven't thought this through. Look, what Trump realized, and you have to give him credit for this, you know, he has this sort of animal instinct for weakness. And he looked at the Republican Party and said, these people really don't believe in what they say they believe. And if I promise to give them power, don't let me get away with anything. And he was exactly right. You know, he basically said, look, they say they're all for law and order and they want to do this. But look, I'm going to get the contract at the port and I'm going to dish off pieces of the port contract. And they're not going to care that I'm paying bribes to get that contract as long as they get what they want. And
that's a good point. I think about people in the GOP, our own Senator Mike Lee, who talked about being a constitutional conservative. He's run on that a long time. He talks about his own father, Rex Lee. He has designs of sitting on the Supreme Court. I think about our Congressman Chris Stewart, who before Trump was elected called him our Mussolini, and now he's one of the biggest Trump backers out there. Where do they go? If Trump loses in 2020, what happens to them? Are they able to return to things the way they were before? Is Mike Lee able to say, you know, I still revere the Constitution?
People can say whatever they want. You know, it was hard to find Nazis in 1946 in Germany. I think, look, it ultimately doesn't matter what they say. It's what people say, because they only have power because of people. So I go back to what happened to the party with African-Americans. So in 1956, Eisenhower gets almost 40% of the black vote. That drops to 7% with Goldwater, who was against the Civil Rights Act in 1964. Now, you could have made a good case. I probably would have made this, that, okay, once the Civil Rights Bill is passed, African-Americans will come back to the Republican Party. In some numbers, you know, because of conservatism, cultural conservatism, a very cultural faith, entrepreneurship, patriotism. But it never happened. So that was 64. He got 7%. Donald Trump got maybe 7.5. So going up 0.5% every 60 years, that's like not a winning trajectory, you know. So at the year, you know, 3040, we'll be back up, you know. I think the same thing's going to happen now. So take Hispanics, right? You know, it wasn't like Goldwater was out there attacking African-Americans. Trump is attacking Hispanics. So are you really going to believe that, you know, Donald Trump calls your father-in-law a rapist? I don't think so. And look at what's happened with Asian Americans. I mean, they used to support Republicans like 70%. And now they're like 70% against Republicans. So it wasn't like we were out attacking Asian Americans, at least not until recently when Trump started attacking Chinese. Kind of like he had a list, well, I forgot to attack them. What is it? We got to go back and get those. But they got the joke that if you weren't white, you weren't welcome in the party. You know, there's an old saying that you believe what you're willing to fight for. And I think that's what the Republican Party's proven. And they don't believe in anything except defeating Democrats. I don't get it on multiple levels. I mean, one thing you say about politicians is they have pretty big egos, which doesn't bother me in the least. So do great artists, writers, athletes, musicians. But why don't they realize how they're going to be remembered? I'm not there in 20 years from now. I'm talking about like 2 years from now. I mean, history ain't going to be written by Fox. And how are you going to want to be the guy that said he was Mussolini and then went with him, or someone who stood up for what you believed? And so you lose a primary. I mean, so what? You know, we used to say, if you're not willing to, if you stand for nothing but re-election, you don't stand for anything. You know, I believed all this stuff. And you look at me and you tell you Mitt Romney, he was heroic.
It's astonishing to me that Mitt Romney has gone from the Republican standard bearer in 2012 to pretty much persona non grata on the right. Here in Utah, he still has good approval ratings. I think that he can hold that Senate seat as long as he wants it. I don't know if he's going to want another term in Washington, given, you know, what has happened to the Republican Party, unless there's a calculation there among some people in the Republican Party that Trump loses in 2020 and we can just say, well, you know, that was a mistake and we're going to wipe our hands of it. I don't think that that's the case, but I'm wondering where Mitt Romney fits going forward.
Look, I would never speak for the senator. I think he's been a profile in courage. The party has been a profile in cowardice. And I think that's how it's going to be remembered. Nobody's going to remember the. You really think they're going to say, yeah, you know, there was Donald Trump who brought two people to the stage of the Republican convention because they waved guns at black people. But, you know, we did cut corporate tax rates, marginal tax rates. Really? You really think so? I don't think so. It's just extraordinary. So, you know, one of the things that I come to, which saddens me, but, you know, maybe we should just understand the cowardice is the norm and the courage is all the more exceptional. I mean, no one can convince me. I mean, I ask you this, like, it sounds like a joke, but I don't mean it as a joke. If this Republican Party was in charge in 1776, you think we wouldn't still be, like, celebrating the Queen's birthday? You know what they'd say? What are we going to do, fight the king? Are you out of your mind? Most powerful army in the world? We just got to work this out. And that's what they would have done. The people who won't stand up to Donald Trump wouldn't stand up to King George. I mean, it's like a joke. And it's shameful. They're all going to lose. And what's going to happen to the Republican Party is what happened to the Republican Party in California. It went from being the beating heart of the Republican Party, the electoral citadel, to third place. That's what's going to happen. Now, it's kind of like the subprime mortgage crisis. It's easy to predict what's going to happen and how long it'll take. But, you know, I came across this statistic that literally, I mean, I had to sit down when I read this. Of those who are 15 years old and under in America, the majority are non-white. So I'd say the odds that they're going to be 18 and non-white look really good. What is that going to do to the Republican Party? That's a death sentence. You know, this celebration of white grievance that is the Republican Party now. And, you know, you got to hunt somebody under 30 with dogs who's for Donald Trump. I mean, you get all these freaks and cast-offs, you know, the Charlie Kirks of the world, you know. These are just, you know, the thing is, there's always been a culture of hate in America and a culture of politics of hate. It's just never been embraced by a major party. I mean, George Wallace ran as a Democrat. Okay. He did well. Largest rally in political history in Massachusetts was the George Wallace rally. But he didn't become the Republican nominee, the Democratic nominee. And political parties in our system should serve a circuit breaker function. And nobody pulled the circuit breaker on Trump. And this is what they're going to get. I think Trump's going to lose, and I think all these senators are going to lose, most of them.
So that's, I was going to get to that. What do you think is going to happen in 2020? I didn't mention this in the intro, but you're doing work with the Lincoln Project. We've had some of your colleagues on to talk about that. So I understand what you're trying to do, and you just answered my last question. What do you think is going to happen in 2020? But how ugly do you think this election is?
I am the most anti-conspiratorial person in politics, because if you work in politics, you realize it's really pretty boring. And, you know, it's like, and is there voter fraud? Look, is there elephantitis in America? Yeah. But there's a reason there's like a National Cancer Center, not a National Elephantitis Center. It's really not a big problem. I think this period between now and November 3rd is the most dangerous period in American history since the Civil War. Donald Trump will do anything to stay in power. And he will do anything to delegitimize a race that he might lose. And he knows that Republicans will do nothing. He's tested them. So he knows. He's like a guy, you know, who's going to rob the bank, who's cased the bank and understands what he can do. So, I use this as an example. Say it's November 1st. Donald Trump is losing. There's reports of voter irregularity in Dade County, Florida, which there usually are. He calls up Chad Wolf, the head of DHS, and sends in whoever those guys are running around in camouflage, and they take the boxes. Who's going to stop them? The security guard at Dade County Courthouse? I don't think so. So then courts go crazy, and within hours, they order them to return the boxes, but say a couple of those boxes have been opened. And then you have chain of custody questions. What are you going to do? You're going to have an election without Dade County? You're going to have a revote?
Yeah.
And Trump has always benefited from the inability to imagine Trump. You couldn't imagine that we wouldn't have a platform. You couldn't imagine that he was going to win. You couldn't imagine that he would steal taxpayers' dollars to put on an event at the White House. I mean, he turned the White House into a crime scene, and Republicans went along with it. I mean, I've shot in the White House a lot. The degree to which we went to not break the law. I mean, you could only shoot in the residence. You couldn't even get a Coke from him. And it's not that somebody was standing there with a gun over your shoulder to enforce it. You did it out of respect. It was the law. You're in the damn White House. You're not going to break the law. And, you know, the weird thing to me, Brian, all these politicians I know, I don't know any of them that would have done this in a million years. And yet they go along with Trump doing it. I mean, the people I know, even the ones that have completely won over for Trump, they still go out of their office to make fundraising calls. They'll stand on the street or they'll go to the senatorial committee. Not like they're going to get caught. And yet they go along with Trump doing this. So are they really looking forward to Joe Biden being renominated in the White House? They're okay with that?
I don't like to play the game. If Obama had done this, then the Republicans would have set Washington on fire. But what they're doing is they're creating a permission structure for another president down the line, whether they be Republican, Democrat, bull moose, whatever, to do this sort of thing. I was speaking with a friend of mine, and he said, you know, the thing about Trump, everything that he's been able to do, all the norms that he's been able to shatter, and you mentioned this, he's transactional. He doesn't have any conviction behind what he wants to do. What terrifies this guy is that someone's going to come along like Trump, but with conviction behind what he wants to do. And he said that will be a very, very dangerous time for this country.
Of course it will. Look, you know, one of the things, if you ever talk to like foreign correspondents who've covered a lot of war zones, one of the things that always struck me is they always talk about like how quickly a civil society can devolve. So how do you go from the Sarajevo stadium, from the Olympic stadium to a torture center? It didn't take long. And the same people. The idea that this America is going to stay the same with this, it's a childish notion. It is what we make it. And I think it's why these Republicans are so shameful. You know, I don't think that they're patriots. I don't think they're traitors, but I don't think they're patriots.
Stuart Stevens is a media consultant and political strategist. His book is It Was All a Lie, How the Republican Party Became Donald Trump. He currently is consulting for The Lincoln Project. Remember to leave a rating or review of this podcast at iTunes or Apple Podcasts. We're just getting started here, and this is a great way to help us build our audience. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Schott.